Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Last week was a tough one for me. My mom died last Thursday, October 5th. Today's show is dedicated to my mom, Jacqueline. And, you know, I'm not sure she totally understood what podcasting is and what the show is about. She certainly had a general idea that it was for the good of nonprofits. And what she would want is for me to keep going and, you know, do a great show in her memory. So that's where we are. And also related to that, I want to welcome two new listeners, Henry and Sue in Old Tappan, neighbors of my mom. Welcome, Henry and Sue. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd be thrown into Parascovitica triophobia if you scared me with the idea that you missed today's show. Development assessments. What are they? When do you need one? What's included? How do you use the info that you get? Glenn Coffold of G Collaborative walks us through it all. On Tony's Take Two, Giving Tuesday. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven, and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant. Also by Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. You're not a business, you're a nonprofit. Aplos Accounting, software designed for nonprofits, NonprofitWizard.com. And Telos, credit and debit card processors, your passive revenue stream, Tony.ma/TonyTelos. It's a pleasure to welcome to the studio, first-time guest, Glenn Coffold. He has been a successful nonprofit leader for 30 years. He created G Collaborative, spelled with a K, in 2010 to provide strategic advising to organizations, particularly those in transition or startup phase. He's also co-founder and co-author of the blog at fundraisingwonks.com. His business is at gcollaborative.com, and he's at fundraisingwonk. And I'm very pleased to welcome Glenn Coffold to the studio.
Thanks so much, Tony. Great to be here.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming on. Should we shout out your mom for her 80th birthday?
I'm here in town to celebrate my mom's 80th birthday this weekend.
You want to, what's her name?
Peg Coffold.
Peg. Happy birthday, Peg. Happy 80. Hope you have a wonderful wonderful night out with your family. Everybody gathered for the big celebration. Cool. All right. Development assessments. I feel like we should just start with, what is it?
Well, I'll give you an analogy. It's like, imagine if you haven't gone to the doctor for 10 years and somebody in your family dies early and that kind of shakes you up. So you go to the doctor and they ask you a ton of questions. They do lots of blood work, lots of scans, all sorts of tests to really give you a baseline of how you are, you know, how your health is. So fundraising assessments are very much the same thing. It's looking at... you know, how you've been fundraising. I usually go back about 5 years. What are you doing? How successful is it? What's it costing? All sorts of metrics. We interview tons of people. And we look at not just fundraising, but things in the organization that affect fundraising or impacted by fundraising. It could be your board and how your board's engaged in it. Your other volunteers. It could be staffing. It could be technology. Could be policies and procedures, governance issues of the board. We often get into a lot of different things.
Okay. If you're, and I get a lot of requests for help getting to the next level. Mm-hmm. How do we get to the next level? And a lot of times those are organizations that are very event driven. Mm-hmm. They have a gala, maybe they have something else, but they're like one or two main events and then just, you know, sort of not well organized around individual fundraising. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a case for, you know, an assessment to see where you could go, and also to calculate your ROI on those couple of events. Events can be enormous time sucks and not for so much money sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's one of the things that we look at, and it's an area in an assessment that I am really hard on my client about.
Okay.
I am the anti-event fundraiser. Yeah. I'm never happier, you know, when I'm killing a gala off. And, you know, so many, and, you know, and I go into these organizations and the development director hates the gala, the executive director hates the gala, but you've got board members, you have volunteers that love these things. And the assessment, you know, honestly looks at them. and looks at the data.
The time that goes into
them. The time that goes into it. And most...
I mean, we have to make sure the flowers match the bunting. I mean, it's crazy what goes into these.
Exactly. And you know, many of my clients don't even calculate the staff time that goes into a gala.
Oh, that's a big oversight.
It's a big oversight. And, you know,
it's enormous.
It's
hundreds of hours.
Yeah, I'm excited when I work with an organization that's actually calculated it.
Yeah.
And when you put all this together and you present data like this to boards, especially, you know, they're like, oh, okay. And, you know, and I've worked with organizations that have, you know, killed off their galas because they saw that it really wasn't working.
Yeah, yeah.
But part of the assessment is not just a recommendation to stop a gala or a golf tournament.
I hope not.
But right. Here's what you can do instead. Here's, you know, here's how you can raise more money. Great, you know, case.
How about before you go? Okay, yeah. Case in point. I love cases. I love stories. But how about how to transition out of? I mean, we can't just, you know, I mean, can you do you share advice how to transition away? Because we can't just tell everybody no more gala. I mean, maybe we got to scale it down a little bit or
sure.
Make a public case. I mean, advice on moving away, transitioning away from the gala.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, we work with our clients on that. You know, so case in point, I did an assessment years ago for a community college system out in California, and they had two galas. One broke even, and they were basically entertaining faculty and staff, so nothing. And then the other one, you know, maybe made $30,000 or $40,000. And when we announced to the board that this needed to go away, this gala just needed to go away, we created a middle donor program. We created a program to attract donors between, in that case, $1,200 and $10,000 a year. You know, with a emphasis on monthly giving to help it be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and design and launch that program for them. Now, their last gala netted $40,000 before they factored in staff time. We launched this new program.
Oh, before factoring staff
time. Before factoring
staff
time.
They may have even been
losing. Quite likely.
Yeah.
We created this new program. In 5 months, they brought in 59 donors. Some of them were new. Some of them were gala sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
So it was part of the strategy to move those donors over. And we raised over $100,000.
From the 59.
From the 59 people. And it cost me the design and printing of a brochure.
Yeah.
That was it. Yeah. So they raised a lot of money, new donors, sustainable donors.
Right. Exactly. Let's focus on the sustainability because the gala has to be recreated every single year.
Absolutely.
It feels like, I mean, you're not literally starting from zero. You do have sponsors that maybe have been with you for
sure.
A while, but your honorees are new. It's a whole new working with vendors of honorees and how giving or not your honorees may be around that. There's a lot of startup time, even if it's a well-established gala. So let's talk about that versus the sustainability of an individual giving program, which is what you're talking about the genesis of.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. Events have to be recreated every year, even though you have an infrastructure. But you create a program like a middle donor program, or you create a monthly sustaining donor kind of program.
Mm-hmm.
You create it once. But you keep working it, and this this study that I was telling you about, we were out in California and we did a lot of house parties, or parlor parties, some people call them. So I had board members, I had volunteers who were opening their home, and you know, bringing in their networks of people, bringing in existing donors in a much more intimate way, in a way where the staff could really make connections to those donors and build relationships with those donors. And with the right stewardship, you have the ability to continue to renew those donors without having to go through the whole expense of creating a gala just to get return guests.
And so much more satisfying, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Instead of working with the caterer and the band and the DJ and the videographer and et cetera, the florist, you're working directly with your donors to sustain them, to build those relationships so that they are going to be with you indefinitely.
Yeah,
and that's so much more satisfying than whether the bunting matches the flowers.
And working with board members to host these house parties, I mean, you know, how many people out there have had board members who've said, oh, I can't ask my friends for money, I'm afraid to ask. But, you know, it's easier and more comfortable to do a house party. So your board members, your volunteers, feel good about what they've done.
Yes.
The organization's building those relationships and getting the revenue for a lot less cost.
All right, hold your thought. We got to take a break. I'm mixing up now the the sponsor announcements. We have so many of them. So we're going to go out just briefly, and I'm going to talk about Pursuant, because they will help you find your existing donors. I mean, Glenn is helping you get new donors. Now, once they're in your database, your existing donors, some of them are hiding. They're primed for upgrade once they've been with you for a while. How do you identify those ready for upgrade, deepen those relationships? Their next free webinar is Finding Hidden Gems Lurking in Your File, aptly named. It's on October 17th at 1 o'clock Eastern, but that doesn't matter because you can follow the archive. You can watch the archive. So if you can make it on October 17th at 1 Eastern, great. But if you can't, like the vast majority of us, sign up anyway, and you'll get an email about when the archive is ready. You register at the Nonprofit Radio listener landing page, which is tony.ma/pursuant. Also, Pursuant has a new content paper for you, 2017 Digital Year-End Fundraising Field Guide. Okay, that's a bit of a mouthful. But what are the channels and the advertising strategies that give you the highest ROI? Glenn and I are talking about ROI for events. Check this out, the field guide, to help you tweak your year-end campaign based on donor expectations, get insider tips on digital fundraising. There's a whole lot more in this content paper. You go to the Nonprofit Radio listener landing page, tony.ma/pursuant with a capital P. Okay, Glenn, thank you very much for your indulgence. We got to do this a couple times.
Absolutely.
It's a new format for me, but I think it's hopefully it's going to work if you're willing.
I'm ready.
You're not walking out.
No.
Okay. All right. So now it's my challenge to remember exactly where we were. Okay. We're talking about parlor meetings.
Yes.
These intimate gatherings that are going to be so much more satisfying, and you're going to have so much more time with more meaningful connections, more meaningful donors than a room full of people that you have to sift through to get through to the ones that are the half a dozen on your list that you need to talk to that night.
Exactly. You know, and at parlor events or house parties, you have people who are coming because they know why they're coming and they want to be there. Yeah. You know, how many galas? All right, I'm going to this gala because my friend bought a table and I need to help fill
Precisely.
It. And you don't even know why you're there.
Yeah.
I'd rather, as a development director, I'd rather have a house party once a month than have to do a gala once
and
a year.
And focus on the five or six couples.
Exactly.
100% of whom are viable,
exactly.
interested, they know why
exactly.
they're there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I hope we've made that point. I think we have.
Yeah.
We beat it up. All right. Galas. It doesn't only apply to golf. Golf outings could be another another time suck with small ROI when you really analyze it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's an important part of development assessment. So, all right. Give me some of what you're going to get in a development assessment. Let's do it this way. What do you get in one of these?
So, we ask you for lots of data. The people who are pulling the data for my clients all curse me out, but we often end up as friends. So we're asking for a lot of information, a lot of data. We do a lot of interviews. And then you get a report back that has that data interpreted mm-hmm. for you. So, you know, we might have a section in the report on annual giving. And it'll be, okay, here's the data, here's what we found, here are the trends. And I find that many executive directors, board members, they don't see the data at this level. Maybe the development director is looking at it, but in a lot of small shops, they don't even have time to really do that. So you'll get that data. We'll give you our analysis. All right, here's what we see is going on. You know, for example, this was happened with one of my clients. Their annual giving went down for 2 years. And I went back and I said, why the dip? Well, it turned out they had changed their name after a merger with another organization. And their Ooh. Core donor base yeah. didn't know
branding problem. Serious.
So we look at the analysis and then we'll give the recommendations. So, you know, I have a client now that's got a direct mail program, and they're sending the same letter to their donors, their lapsed donors, and acquisition names. So we'll say, you know what? Look at this way. Here are some you know, different ways to approach this to increase your success with that. So the plan is not just here's the data, here's our analysis. Here's some actionable things. Here are things that you can do going forward. And we try to break those down into short-term and long-term best bets for the client.
You mentioned interviews. Who gets interviewed?
So we typically, these always start with the CEO. I actually won't take on an assessment project if the CEO is not my client. because I want the top leadership doing this. So it's the CEO, could be the COO, could be the chief marketing person, the chief financial officer, the development director, everybody on the development team, no matter what their position is. Mm. And then usually the board chair, the chair of a development committee if they have one, some other board members if they're engaged in fundraising. So we try to get perspectives from all different sides.
Any donors? Putting aside the board members, let's hope that 100% of the board members are.
One would hope.
That's often not a problem. I'm sure that's often part of your assessment, but let's assume they are.
Yeah.
So putting aside board member donors, any just straight major donors? I'm bleeding into more like a campaign assessment.
That's more like a campaign feasibility study.
Feasibility study. Thank you.
I'm trying to think back of the assessments that we've done. I don't think we've interviewed any outside donors who are not board members. Because they're typically not involved in the day-to-day fundraising operation of an organization.
All right. When is a good time to do an assessment?
Assessments happen. I mean, anytime's a good time if you're going to take a look.
If you're going to hire G Collaborative,
anytime's a good time.
Today's ideal.
Today's ideal.
Everybody's taking calls.
They typically happen because something has happened in the organization. So it can be a new CEO who's coming in, who wants to get a handle on what's going on in fundraising. I did an assessment last year where a longtime CEO was getting ready to retire, and she wanted to make sure she was leaving the organization in a good place for the next person.
Oh, that's really cool.
I really respected her.
How many of those? Have you done more than one of those? Where the person's leaving and...
I've done two.
I would think they'd be rare. That's very forward thinking.
So it's, you know, it's a change in leadership, or there's a new VP of development or director of development, and the CEO wants to really kind of give that person a foundation to start to build from. It could be an organization that has gone through a merger. I did one of those last year, two organizations that had recently merged, and the CEO.
Now, it sounds like you had another case you told me where the branding was not very good after the merger. That was not the same.
That was not the same client. This was a client that, two organizations merged, two development shops, and the CEO said, hey, come in, take a look at what both of these development operations are doing and tell me how I should organize this going forward.
Yeah.
And so that was a fun project to work on because it was really two assessments in one, and then gave her a plan going forward of, right, what needs to remain local, what can be centralized, and how do you leverage the resources you have and make sure you're, you know, really operating at peak efficiency. So a merger happens, an organization's getting ready for a campaign. And because very often in a campaign, you want to start with an assessment of your current program, or a situation I have now as a client is going into a strategic planning process. And I've never seen a strategic plan that didn't increase our resources. So they've said, we want to do an assessment of our development program concurrent with a strategic plan, because we know there's things that we want to do and we're going to have to up our game with fundraising.
Now, if you are going into a campaign, you don't see this as, being subsumed in a campaign feasibility study?
They're really two different things. A development assessment often happens before a campaign feasibility study. So you're assessing the organization's ability to do a campaign and the ability to be able to sustain their annual fundraising while they're in a campaign. So you really want to make sure your house is in order before you go into a campaign. Whereas a campaign feasibility study, we're working internally, of course, on case for support and gift pyramids and all those kinds of tools. But that study is very external with potential donors, lots of interviews, focus groups, really getting a sense of the donor's perception of the organization, of the leadership, their reaction to the case for support, where they might fit in a campaign, you know, where they could see themselves, you know, what issues are important to them vis-a-vis this organization.
That's a good explanation. Yeah, one is more internally focused, internal, and the other is outward looking at perceptions.
Exactly.
Of the organization. Okay, cool. Thank you. All right. So you gather a lot of data.
Mm-hmm.
You do a lot of interviews. Then I guess you go home and assimilate all the info you've got, And what's the next step?
So I hide in my office, and I, you know, as you said, I assimilate the data, I do the analysis, we write the report, and then, you know, along the way, along that process, I generally have a lot of conversations with the development director. You know, I'll do a chart on, you know, major gift giving over the last 5 years, and I might send that to the development director and say, hey, is this right? Did I get this right? And I had that situation recently where it wasn't right. And, you know, there were reasons why it wasn't right. And, you know, they fixed the data that they gave me, and we went on. So there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of questions that happen. I'll circle back with people I interviewed, say, hey, I think you said this, but, you know, explain better. Then we create a draft report. It is sent to the CEO for his or her review. And that's important because we want to make sure that there's nothing in the report that the CEO thinks will be inflammatory, or, you know, sometimes I'll say, I agree with you, but let's present it a different way. Or there may be issues around staffing. I won't, for example, in a report, criticize staff that's there. But if I see something, I'll write a separate memo or have a phone conversation with the executive director.
Okay.
So we go through that process. There's also a verbal interim report before they get the draft. So when we're in the middle of the writing, you know, I'll schedule a call with a client and say, all right, just these are some of the key themes that we're seeing, and this is what's likely to come up.
Okay.
So we send in the draft, get the feedback, finish the final report, and then present to the organization. It's usually to the board of directors. It might be to the senior leadership team. It could be to the development staff. We will do a PowerPoint presentation that doesn't go through every single page of the report, because some of these reports can be lengthy. But we'll give a presentation with the highlights in person to the client.
All right. Now, so anything – well, first I want to remind listeners we're talking to – I'm talking to – well, we all are. I'm channeling all of you. So I don't know if that means I or we, but I'll use I, but you're all here. Glenn Coffold, principal founder of G Collaborative. We're talking about development assessments, how he does them and what they are generally. So you said anything negative that you see staff-wise, it goes in a separate sort of executive memo. Now, does the board – is the board privy to that, or you leave that to the CEO to deal with? You wouldn't expose, let's say, you know, you found a really weak vice president, you know, it's key leadership position. You think he or she is particularly weak. You would only share that with the CEO?
Yeah, exactly.
And then you'd be more diplomatic. What would you say to the board as you're in your presentation? Share.
I wouldn't say anything to the board unless the CEO wanted me to.
Okay.
As I said before, I consider the CEO my client, and he or she knows best how to communicate with the board. And I don't want to say anything to a board that is going to cause problems for the CEO the next morning. So if there's a situation, and I had one a couple of years ago, somebody had been promoted into the VP position who just wasn't right. You know, this person was excellent at donor relationships, was heading stewardship previously. And we said to the CEO, you know what? Put this person back into stewardship, because that's where they're happy, that's where they're good, that's where they're effective. This person isn't right to be the VP. But I say that to the CEO because I'll let him or her, you know, decide. And the CEO is the one who decides on hiring and firing and deploying staff. It's not shouldn't be the board's responsibility.
Right,
so
right.
I feel then the CEO can deal with that whatever way makes sense.
What if we alluded to this earlier? Board fundraising is lackluster. It's not where it should be. It's not 100%. How do you convey that to the board? First, what they should be doing, and then how they can improve themselves.
So the report always includes a section on board giving. So we will look at you know, the percentage of participation in giving, the average gift, you know, are they giving to annual giving? Are they giving to a campaign, or what are they giving to? We don't present the data name by name, although we do it name by name, but we don't present it that way. So it'll give them that snapshot. But we
there's a dog in the hallway. Okay. We can't hide it. We may as well shout it out. Hello, dog. Not in the studio. It's on the other side of a door. It sounded small enough, but I still want it on the other side of the door.
So we, you know, we will in the report give suggestions on ways board members can get involved. And then I will often have conversations with the VP of development on here's what I found. And I'll ask the question, you know, how are you engaging the board? Board involvement in fundraising is not a one size fits all. You know, I've seen people say, oh, okay, next board meeting, bring five names. You know, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
You have to work with board members one on one.
Yeah. Some people may want to do a lot more than bring a list of five names.
Exactly.
Some are not comfortable doing that, but they might be comfortable hosting a party with those five couples.
Exactly.
So, you know, you got to meet everybody where they are. Fundraising is more than giving. I mean, they all should be giving.
Yeah.
In some respect, as you were outlining, but beyond that, beyond their own personal gifts, and that's not one size fits all either.
No,
But beyond that, you have to meet them where they are, where their comfort level is.
Yeah, and it, you know, board engagement also comes in other parts of the assessment. So, you know, in the context of annual giving, we were talking before about the house parties and middle donor programs and things like that. Most of my clients don't have those kinds of programs, or if they do, they're really not activating them. So I will talk in the report. I'll make recommendations. Your board members can do this, and some of the value behind doing middle donor programs. And I talk about board involvement in donor relations and stewardship, because we look at that in the report. I'll make recommendations for how to involve board members in thanking donors and in participating in ongoing donor engagement programs.
Okay. What's your sense of how successful nonprofits are in having robust board fundraising programs, or having the kind of participation that they ought to have? You've done a lot of assessments. Do you still feel like this is a weak area for a lot of organizations?
It is a weak area, but I question our expectations around that. So this is what got me going on this. A couple of years ago, I presented at a AFP conference in Fort Lauderdale, and the closing session was a panel discussion. I don't even remember what the topic was, but there was a lot of Q&A, and somebody in the audience asked the question of how can we get our board members to raise more money? And one of the panelists up there is a woman named Terry Temkin, who's since become a friend. And she, you know, she sat there and she said, you know what? We just have to get over ourselves. Fundraising is staff driven. If you get one or two or three board members who will help you, great. But our, you know, I think our expectations on board involvement have to change.
This is pretty radical.
It's very radical.
99% of the guests, and you're the other percent that I've had for 7 years, have said, you know, it needs to be where new fundraising initiatives begin. It needs to be 100% support. Board members need to do their part, whatever their part of comfort is, whatever their comfort level is in fundraising. You know, the expectation is generally very, very high.
And yet we're all frustrated because people aren't living up to their expectations.
But, should we reduce the expectations, or should we still keep trying to get board members to step up?
I think we need to think about our expectations of what is really likely. And then going back to what I said a moment ago about personalizing board engagement. Don't tell them bring five names. Don't ask five people.
Okay.
Work with us to come up with a plan that's comfortable for you and makes you feel good.
Okay. Well, let remind me that we're talking about this in case I forget, because I have another sponsor announcement. But the subject of the expectations versus the reality, I want to come back to. And we got a lot more with Glenn and development assessments coming up. Right now, Telos, credit card and payment processing. Does your organization need a passive residual revenue stream that pays you every month? All right. Telos is a new sponsor. It's only been a couple weeks. We have a long time with them, so we got to work into this. But here's what I mean: we're talking about credit and debit card processing. That's what they do. As a partner nonprofit, so they're going to be asking you for referrals within your community. We'll get to that, and you, as one of their partners, get 50% of every dollar that Telos gets. So every dollar of revenue, not profit, every dollar of revenue, 50% of that from your referrals goes to you, all right? And they have an incredible offer that is only for nonprofit radio listeners. You refer a business in your network. Think businesses owned by board members. Think local companies that support you in your community. Could be an independent artist, family members. If you're a smaller organization, any body or organization entity that accepts credit cards. That's what we're talking about. Okay. Telos is going to evaluate their current arrangement with their payment processor. If Telos cannot save that person money, they're going to give you $250. You, the organization that referred them. If Telos can't save them money, you get $250. All right. You're only going to find this at tony.me/TonyTelos. tony.me/TonyTelos. It's all described there in a very succinct paragraph. The offer for nonprofit radio listeners. Think about the companies that you can refer and check that out. It's their landing page, tony.me/TonyTelos. I think that, okay, we're going to go back to Glenn. So that, yes, Tony's take two, of course. Because I'm on the wrong page. That's the problem. Okay. My latest video is Giving Tuesday. And if you don't have Giving Tuesday totally sewn up, that's okay. It's not too late, although too late is approaching. Check out the video. You know, we just devoted a show to this 2 weeks ago. So, you know, we had the advice of Jessica Schneider from 92nd Street Y, Amy Sample Ward, our social media contributor. They had ideas and assurances that you still can do something. You know, you might start small, of course, first year, if it's your first year. But we do recommend, you know, get in on Giving Tuesday at some level. And so you can check out that show from 2 weeks ago. And plus, my video has lots of links. It's basically a Giving Tuesday roundup. So you find the video where else? You know where. I mean, you don't even need me to say it. The Giving Tuesday video, it's at tonymartinetti.com. And that is Tony's take two. And I feel like we should do live listener love. Et cetera. And the et cetera, of course, is very important. So live listeners are in Tampa, Florida, Woodbridge, New Jersey. Woodbridge, very consistent. Woodbridge, been over several weeks, maybe even more, even longer. Woodbridge, thank you so much for being with us. Live listener love out to you. Oakland, California. Wonderful. Newburgh, Indiana. Wonderful. Live listener love to you. Let's do some live love on Facebook. Jackie Pavisi, Maria Semple, John Campy, Rick Shamness. Live love to you on Facebook. Thank you so much. Facebook, can you like? Can you share? Can you send? What do you send, stars or something? No, that's on Periscope. Somehow you can like this, like the Facebook live video, and little things stream into the video. I forget on Periscope, they're hearts. I don't know what they are.
You can even put a heart on. I forget Facebook. What they are. They like you or they love
they
you.
They like so and love.
Give them lots of love
and share. Too. Oh, sharing yeah. Sharing is critical. So Facebook live love. And let's go abroad for some live listener love. We've got Toko Razawa, Japan. Konnichiwa. We've got Munich, Germany. Guten Tag. And we've got also Tokyo, Japan. Konnichiwa for Tokyo. And someone in the Dominican Republic. Oh, Dominican Republic, thinking about you. So glad you are with us. Thank you. Live love to all the live listeners. And, of course, the podcast pleasantries. Come very quickly soon after, live listener love. Over 12,000 of you listening on your devices in your time, whenever it's convenient for you, pleasantries to the podcast listeners. Thank you for being with us, and the affiliate affections to our AM and FM station listeners throughout the country. Affections to you, however or whenever your station fits you into their schedule. I'm so glad you're with us. Let your studio know. Let your station know. Affections to you, our AM and FM listeners. Okay, Glenn, I know what we were talking about. We were talking about the expectations. This is going to be a challenge for me, but the expectations versus, because now in this new format, I don't get a break. The expectations versus the reality of board giving. So you're feeling like, am I hearing you correctly? You think we should reduce the expectations?
Well, I want to clarify one thing. I don't think we should reduce expectations about board members giving themselves to the organization. You know, if you're on a board,
100%,
you have to 100%. And okay. Whether an organization sets a give or get number, or some organizations say it's, you know, one of your top three charities,
stretch gift for you,
stretch right. gift, you know, right. That 100%. There are no excuses for that.
All right.
Where I'm saying we have to be more realistic is board expectations for fundraising, and not to necessarily to diminish our expectations that they participate, but to look inward first, and this is where the assessment can come in, is how are we engaging with our board members? Yeah. What are we asking them to do? Are we doing it individually?
Meeting them where they are at their comfort level. Yeah. It might just be something very small.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, you also have part of that. I see this with, you know, with some of my clients. You have boards. I'm thinking of a couple of organizations that are umbrella organizations in an industry, and they have executive directors of other nonprofits populating their boards. Well, it's unrealistic to expect that those other executive directors are going to fundraise because they've got that responsibility for their own organization. So you have to look at board, you know, board composition. You have to look at how people were recruited. I had a client recently who said, my board members were not, when they were recruited, they weren't asked to give money. We need to change that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So you know, if you have that kind of situation, then maybe you have to say, you know, I don't know what we can expect them to do at this point. But I think we have to be realistic about expectations. Okay. And again, one size definitely doesn't
fit. All right. I guess I'm playing devil's advocate. I think I'm challenging a little bit. But so do you feel that every board member should do something? Again, this is beyond their own personal gift. Do something to support the fundraising, even if it's just ask a friend, or, you know, if it's something very small. Do you feel everybody should be doing something, or do you feel that there are some board members that we just, you make your personal gift and end it there? Is that appropriate?
No, I think that every board member can do something and should do something. It could be, you were just talking about Giving Tuesday. You know, there's no reason why every board member, even if they've got competition, you know, in their own jobs, they can't fundraise that much for you. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why they can't promote your Giving Tuesday campaign on their own social media, personal social media pages. There's no reason why board members can't pick up the phone an hour before a board meeting and just call 10 donors to thank them for their gifts. Because that's important too.
Thank yous are a great one.
You know, there are lots of ways that board members can participate in the fundraising process that isn't sitting down and asking somebody for $25,000.
For sure.
And the phone calls to donors are really important. Sometimes, you know, I've used board members to come with me on solicitations. Just having a board member there brings credibility, even if they don't need to ask, or they're not comfortable asking.
Just accompanying you. Well, I think we're saying the same thing then. I mean, it's basically, but it has to be personalized.
It has to be, and
that should really be done at the point where they join the board. Really?
Oh, exactly.
I mean, isn't that what are you going to be, you know, we do have, aside from your personal gift, we expect you're our key volunteers, you're our key stakeholders in this organization. We need you, and we expect you to do something to help our fundraising.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what the different opportunities are and pair you with a mentor on the board who's an established board member. You can tag along him or her, you know. I think there's a lot of value in doing it at the intake stage.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen this happen too. You know, board members come on boards because of other expertise. They have, you know, subject matter expertise, or they bring financial acumen or whatever.
Accounting, law,
whatever.
HR.
Yeah. You know, so, but again, finding a comfortable way for them to be involved, and not expecting them to bring five names, or not expecting them to raise X amount of money in a given year. They may just not be able to do that, but they can make phone calls to thank donors. They can come to donor events and, you know, say hello to people. I mean, there's things that everyone can do.
You talked about there being, I guess, there's midterm and long-term recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something short-term, like within the next month? That's unrealistic. But, not so much.
You know, I think there are things that you can do in donor relations and stewardship that you can turn around that quickly. For example, you know, bringing names to a board meeting and asking everyone to come a half hour early and make phone calls. So those are the kinds of things that you can do pretty quickly.
Okay.
Others take a little more time. And it also depends on the staff availability. I work with a lot of clients that just, their staff are maxed out. So it takes them a little time to change course. And it's also up to the board in a board engagement. I remember an assessment we did a couple of years ago, and one of the recommendations was to create a middle donor program. And I showed them data and all that. And one board member sat there in the meeting, said, "This is brilliant. We have to do this now." She's like, "Okay, who's going to join me? How are we going to get this done and get it done now?" And so sometimes that happens.
It also feels good, very gratifying to have your assessment considered brilliant.
Oh, I love it.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Board member, brilliant. Oh, yeah. Nobody's going to disagree with that. Okay. All right. Yeah, so I'm trying to get – I want listeners to have a sense of what the action items are that come out of an average assessment. So, okay, aside from a middle donor program, so that's the help to transition off the event-driven fundraising that you've been – cycle you've been stuck in, for mm-hmm. years. Okay. Mm-hmm. What else can we expect sort of action item wise?
So a lot of action items, again, in donor relations and stewardship that you can implement immediately. Action items in annual giving. So that's case I mentioned before where a client was putting their acquisition, their Leibunts and Zeibunts in the same mailing. They can change that immediately or as soon as the next time the mailing goes out. Or if it's...
By the way, hold that thought. Now, listeners are going to say, well, how come Tony let him get away with Leibunt, Zeibunt? We have jargon jail on nonprofit radio. But I think, I think Leibunt and Zeibunt is a common. So I'm the arbiter of what's jargon jail and what's not. It's last year, but not this year, and some year, meaning some year in the past, but not this year. And further in the past than last year. That's what Leibunt and Zeibunt is. But I think if you were wondering why, I think this is basic terms.
I think you should be on. A lot of people know.
Yeah. So
that.
Yeah. I am not easing up on jargon jail. So fear not. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
So
lots of interruptions here. You have to. It's hard for you. You have to hold your thoughts too.
It's fine. All right. Things like that. It could be. I've done assessments where they're not doing enough to retain their donors. They're focusing on acquisition, but they're not doing enough to retain donors.
Yes.
So recommendations for
retention,
that.
Critical. I mean, we have something, 70% donor loss, attrition every year? It's crazy.
And we all know it costs more to acquire a donor than it does to retain
a
donor.
Thank you. Guest number 100 who said that. We're drilling it in, but nonetheless still important.
Important.
It's not cliche. It's critical.
Yeah.
Yes, it does cost a lot more. And donor retention. Save your donors. Don't go out and have to replace 70% of your donors every year. No business works like that.
Not at all. So there could be recommendations on all those people that came to your gala. What can you do to try to convert them from being a transactional donor to what I call an intentional donor?
Okay, go ahead and define that, please, jargon jail.
So a transactional donor is I paid a ticket to go to the golf tournament or I paid a ticket to go to your gala. It's a transaction. An intentional gift would be, okay, somebody's come to the gala, and then here's something they like. They go to your website and say, I'm going to become a monthly donor. That's an intentional gift.
Okay.
This comes up a lot in my work. I've been doing a lot of work recently in the hospice, nonprofit hospice world. And so in those kinds of organizations.
I have my own experience with hospice. Because around my mom, who spent just her last day in a hospice.
I'm honored to work in that space.
Oh, my gosh. The end of life care.
Yeah.
So critical. So critical.
But money that the gifts that come into nonprofit hospices are memorial gifts. So your mom died.
Right.
And
we're encouraging. Yes, we are
50
encouraging.
People might make gifts. That's a transactional kind of gift.
Villa Marie Claire in Saddlebrook, if you want to do a gift in memory of Jacqueline Martinetti. Villa Marie Claire, Saddlebrook.
So that's a transactional gift. So where, this is where the art of fundraising comes in. How does that hospice organization take those donors?
Yes.
How do they communicate with them? How do they help them understand?
That's purely a transactional donor otherwise.
Yeah.
Initially.
What their money's for. What nonprofit hospice does. I'm finding it's a little understood part of our healthcare system, our nonprofit healthcare system.
Until you're in a crisis.
Yeah.
So what can an organization like that do to educate on the importance of for the patient, the importance and value for the family. And so they can make that something becomes in your, as you call, an intentional donor versus a transactional donor. Okay. Stick with me. We got a lot more on development assessments coming up with Glenn, of course. Wegner, CPAs, they do go way beyond the numbers. Major gifts, best practices, and common mistakes could be something that Glenn and his clients would be interested in. It's one of the archived webinars that Wegner creates. It's not done by a CPA. Of course, they bring in outside experts to tell you about major giving. It covers five of each of these, best practices and common mistakes. And then there's a single most important thing you can do to have a more successful major gift program. So they got this one key that that's the hook. It gets you in the webinar, but it's worth it. You need to beef up your major gift program, maybe benchmark yours. I want to talk to Glenn about benchmarking. Make a note of that. Benchmark against others in assessments. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Okay. Benchmark your major gift program against others. It's good to get some outside perspective, I think. So you don't have to register. This one is already archived. You can watch it right now. Wegner, you know, just going way beyond just CPAing. And you'll find it at wegnercpas.com. Click resources, then webinars. If you want to browse everything they offer, click resources, and then you'll see the full collection. Aplos software. Let's figure this out, okay? You're a nonprofit, but you use accounting software made for a business. Now, I had never thought about this until Aplos became a sponsor of Nonprofit Radio, but it makes some sense to me. You need something that's made for you. This is 2017. Software, I mean, there's so much niche software. You're a nonprofit. You shouldn't be using business accounting software like Sage and QuickBooks. Those things were not made for you. Aplos is. It's accounting software designed for nonprofits from the ground up. Okay? Easy, affordable, nonprofit accounting software. They're at nonprofitwizard.com. Now, have you wondered why it's nonprofitwizard.com that I'm asking you to go to instead of aplos.com? Well, very simple. Accountability. Aplos is checking to see how many Nonprofit Radio listeners go to check out their site, and they're doing it through this vanity URL, nonprofitwizard.com. Very simply, if we're not getting the click-throughs and the referrals, they're not going to be a sponsor anymore. It's that simple. So if you have questions about accounting software, if you're not so thrilled with your accounting software, if you're willing to look at alternatives, an alternative that is made for nonprofits, then I need you to go to nonprofitwizard.com, see the value there, and go further if you think it makes some sense for you. Nonprofitwizard.com for Aplos accounting software. Okay. Thank you, Glenn.
My pleasure.
Let's see. I'm going to do... Where were we? I know what I wanted to talk about, benchmarking.
Uh-huh.
But where were we before that? Do you remember? Okay, I don't either.
Yeah.
Benchmarking. Okay. Go back and say, oh, Tony, what a moron. A moron. No. I am not John Kelly, and I'm not talking about the president. But Tony, like, what a moron. You can't remember? But, you know, it's not so easy. You try it sometime. Let's talk about benchmarking.
Yes.
Is that appropriate for... is that appropriate for a development assessment to look outside the world and show where you stand in relation to it?
I haven't done it in the context of my assessment work because there are so many variables, you know, that come into play, you know, in trying to do a benchmark, and that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And so I try to keep the fee on the assessments, you know, reasonable enough. But yeah, there is benchmarking, and I've done some of it. One of my very first clients was a performing arts center, and they hired us to do an assessment, which we did, and, you know, have kept us on. I'm still working with them, you know, 7-8 years later. And they wanted to boost their membership at the $1,000 level and up, and they asked me to do some benchmarking, which I did, which was really very useful to see where they were in comparison. Going back to the hospice field that I was talking about before we went to break, you know, I would love to do some benchmarking on nonprofit hospice conversion rates of those memorial donors, those transactional donors, to intentional donors, and really see, not just to help you see in your nonprofit where you're at with that, but to understand what organizations are doing to bump that up. And, you know, why are some people having a higher conversion rate than others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in the assessment itself, it hasn't come up. Not to say it couldn't.
Okay. Right. Somebody might request it.
Yeah.
But also, you're more internally focused.
More internally focused.
And you have 30 years of experience, so you know what the possibilities are, how a shop can run smoothly, and how to get a rough-running shop to be more smooth.
Yeah.
That's basically the value that people find in your assessments.
Exactly. Right,
essentially. Okay. What do you like to see staff doing with this after it's done? You got these midterm recommendations, long-term recommendations, all the data analysis. It's all been presented. What ideally should staff be doing with this?
Well, staff, leadership.
Staff, we'll get to the board in a second.
Yeah, well, and boards, right. I mean, should really, really internalize it and think about their systems, think about what they're doing. Assessment I just finished, the data collection was very arduous for this particular client, really difficult. And they said to me, you know, after we were done cursing you out, we actually learned a lot from this because we learned there are better ways of tracking data. Mm. So I hope that staff will take the recommendations, and they may not accept all of them, and some of them they can't implement because there just isn't enough staff. And our assessments often will not only look at the staff they have, but help you with recommendations of how you should be staffed.
Mm.
So sometimes they just can't do these things, but they can start to make changes by eliminating galas and golf tournaments to help them move in that direction. But there are changes that they can make around stewardship, around donor relations. So if your organization is, for example, taking 2 weeks to acknowledge a gift, there are immediate things you can do to look at your system, you look at your processes, and tighten them up so you can bring 2 weeks down to 2 days. So I want staff to be internalizing these things and to implementing what makes sense for their organization.
All right, and then how about the board?
The board, the same thing. If there are fundraising initiatives that we recommend, like a middle donor program, like, you know, some activities to start moving your annual fund donors, your middle donors up to major gifts, you know, so there are things that they can start to do in that area. They, as I said before, can have a role in ongoing donor relations.
And also support for this. Maybe this is an impetus for greater fundraising so that there can be more resources to bring on more staff, to get to the next level.
Exactly. You know, there's budget allocations. I've seen these assessments change development committees and what they're focused in on.
Yeah.
So instead of a development committee just sitting there listening to the development director give a report, they're engaging more and they're participating in the process. These assessments are really healthy for board members. And I love doing board presentations because eyes go wide open. They're hearing things they had no idea about. And it's getting them to think.
Yeah. All right. What you've shared a bunch of stories. You have maybe a longer term story where an organization did an assessment and then you heard back from them, or maybe you kept working with them mm-hmm. and they grew as a result of this arduous assessment process?
Great question. And
I'll tell
listeners this was not planned. I didn't know he was going to ask this, but this just came up this week. So my very first client was a community college system in California, did an assessment, and I worked with them for a couple of years to start. We had to merge two foundations and then ran it for a couple of years for them until they could hire somebody. And it's been 5 years since I stopped working with them, and I called the chancellor just this week because I'm writing up our experience there as a case study for another client. They asked me to do a little benchmarking, going back to that topic. And I called her with some questions and how it was going, you know, kind of her own perspective on things. And so this was a situation where, I don't know, they were raising a couple $100,000 a year. They've increased that. And now, 7 years after we did the assessment, they're starting a $15 million campaign. And they're poised to close their first three $1 million gifts. They've never had gifts at that size. They're engaging alumni. They're engaging their retirees. I mean, she really pointed to all of the things that they've been able to do since that assessment. And what's great for me is she has invited me to come back. She wants to reassess their operation and see where it's at, where it's grown over the last 7 years.
Very gratifying.
It is. That's thrilling. I'm
congratulations
thrilled to do it.
For that. Yeah. All right. We got to leave it there.
Okay.
Glenn Caulfield. G Collaborative is his company. You'll find them at gcollaborative.com. And if you go to gcollaborative.com/assessments, Glenn has a lot more information about this. He did it for this show. It's like a landing page for the show. And you can fill out a basic assessment.
Yeah, so there's a little quiz that you can fill out, yeah. And then you submit that, and we will send you our G Collaborative Guide to Development Assessments.
He's also at Fundraising Wonk. Glenn, thank you again so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Next week, oh yeah, you'll like it. Whatever it turns out being, it'll be good. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're supported by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled, Pursuant.com. Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. Aplos Accounting, software designed for nonprofits, Aplos Accounting, NonprofitWizard.com. And Telos Credit and Debit Card Processors, your passive revenue stream, tony.ma/TonyTelos. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is the line producer. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. And this very cool music is by Scott Stein of Brooklyn. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. It was like, yes. It was phone. This email thing is right. Weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperstein.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.